When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the White Towel Podcast, first of 2020. Paul Chapman joined by Ed Willis and Ben Kuzma. Gentlemen, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Happy New Year.
Favorite line of the new year from colleague Steve Simmons, 2020, the year of hindsight.
Very good.
Not bad.
Yep. Yeah, not bad.
This is
for Simmons. Look, I was going to say this, like debate I've had before. It's the 8th, even though it's our first broadcast or podcast, whatever you want to call it, of the new year. Is it too late to be wishing people a happy new year still?
Wow.
Like if you see someone for the first time in 2020 on January 27th, do you still wish them a happy new year?
I think that first week back you can. But I think now that we're into week two, I think it's gone. It's a little like wearing the poppy after November 11th.
It's complicated for me because you see, yesterday, January 7th is Ukrainian Christmas.
Oh, well, okay.
So Ukrainian New Year's is on January 14th.
And I didn't get you anything.
You didn't get me anything. So now what we usually get is a lot of added weight over the month because, you know, you observe both Christmases. So you really...
Do you do the traditional 12-course Ukrainian New Year's Eve?
Yeah. But the best I could do the other night was some bad pierogies from some store.
Dave Komoski, who's my former boss in Winnipeg, as his last name would suggest, proud Ukrainian, and he tried to do the 12-course feast, which is the traditional way to do it. And he got about five courses in, and then he would just throw pickles out and cause the cost. So we had seven courses of pickles on our traditional Ukrainian New Year's Eve dinner.
You make it work somehow. So I didn't get you anything, but what the Canucks did get was a stuffing last night.
Good segue.
So we're going to talk a little bit about not just the game last night, but we're going to talk obviously about what transpired over the festive period in the Canucks' hot streak. Look a little bit at some of their numbers. We'll get into their next 10 games and what lies ahead for them. Then we will talk a little bit about the Canucks' 50th anniversary series as we are now into the 90s. Another very eventful year for the Canucks. So I will throw this out to both of you to start. What happened in Tampa Bay?
Yeah, I thought a bill came due. They hadn't. I know they'd won seven games in a row, and you know the standard sports line is you never critique a loss or you never critique a win. And given everything this organization has been through the last 4 years, I mean the seven wins in a row is a landmark achievement. But there were holes in their game. They went on a four-game winning streak there, right after they lost to Montreal, where they get outshot 152 to 102 over, and they win all four basically because Jacob Markstrom is providing this otherworldly level of goaltending. And I think what we saw in Tampa, it should be a wake up call to them. What happens when they don't get that, you know, that elite, unsustainable quality of goaltending? So I just hope they're paying attention.
Just to follow up on what Ed said, you know, winning solves everything and losing exposes the ugly things. And like you mentioned, they were getting away with wins during the streak that they had no business winning. Of course, the Ranger game where Markstrom makes 49 saves, a career high, stood out. I just think what occurred in Tampa, it was the best thing for them. I mean, if they lose that game 4-2 in an empty net goal, it's like, you know, we played well enough. We were close. When you get slapped around like that, it reminded me of the game in Pittsburgh in late November. They're up 6-3 midway through the third period, and Malkin says, well, that's enough of that. He has a 5-point game. They get hammered 8-6. And a lot of the kids look like a deer in the headlights that night. And I thought there was a lot of similarities last night. I mean, what do you say after two periods? It's 2-2 at one point.
Well, that was the crazy thing. They get that bizarre goal there, and it's 2-2 with, like, what, 5 minutes left in the second period. You figure they're going to get it into the third, and, you know, maybe they find a way to get a point out of that. Maybe they bounce one in off somebody's ass again and get out of it, because, quite frankly, that's the way they've been getting a lot of their wins lately. But I agree. It's, you know, this is, like, this was, like, a textbook case of everything that they've been doing wrong for 2 weeks, but they've been getting away with.
So one thing I'll ask Ben to start, and Ed, your thoughts as well. You know, when you see so many goals in rapid succession like that, and you talk about a meltdown, and it just, I got to laugh. It reminded me of that game in Chicago where Chelsea Dagger became burned into our memory just because it was so many times in a row in short succession. So in a case like that, obviously you lift the goalie, you're hoping for a lift. Maybe, you know, it's a message to the rest of the team. Maybe it's a message to the goalie. Maybe it's just a reset. You're trying to save Jacob Markstrom from more embarrassment. But when you see a meltdown in such a concentrated period of time there, was that Markstrom losing his focus and, as you guys say, a bill coming due, or was it other stuff going on in the ice for you, or a combination?
Well, I know that Markstrom wouldn't be happy with the one rebound he put right into the slot that turned into a goal, a puck going through him and trickling across the goal line. Tracking is a big thing with goalies, and there's a lack of concentration there. And even on the breakaway where he got beat stick side, I thought he committed too early. But having said that, it's really picking away at a guy who really has his game under him. I think the thing that surprised me when they got down 4-2, where was the timeout? You know, Travis Green has talked about, well, we're really careful with that timeout. Maybe we can do it during a TV timeout. Players have talked about taking greater ownership of the bench and on the ice and maybe making sure the younger guys have their head on straight. That's going to be an ongoing thing with this hockey club. But as far as the goaltending goes, I'm surprised that he wasn't yanked a little bit earlier. And let's be honest, they're going to need him the rest of the way. So I would have pulled him maybe after, I don't know which goal, a little bit early, maybe after 4-2. It was just going that way. It was trending, and you could see it. And Bo Horvat talked about it after the game. He said, you know what? When it was 2-2, we thought, you know what? We're going to get a point out of this. And he said, we kind of sat back. And if you watch the way the Canucks play, it's not sexy. It's north-south. It's get the puck in. It's get a turnover. It's jam it in. Let's do something on the power play. But their back check, their shot suppression is horrendous. And you can talk about the defense all we want and how it doesn't defend well enough. But look at the gaps between the forwards and the defense. That was a real wake-up call in Tampa. And we'll see what they can right the ship in Florida.
Ed, you used an interesting word, unsustainable level of goaltending from Jacob Markstrom. And he has been excellent. So was he papered over the cracks? Or was last night just, you know, a game where, as you said, like, eventually they were going to run out of steam somewhere?
Yeah, well, look, I think everybody recognized going into this season the Canucks needed elite goaltending to stay in the playoff race. Now, the question is, you know, how would you define elite? I would say anything. I'd say 918 save percentage. 918 to 920 is kind of what they require for Markstrom, and I can't remember the numbers what the numbers he put up going over that 7-game winning streak, and I know Demko had one win in there, but it was much higher than that. I think over the length of the season, if they get that 918 to 920 out of Markstrom, that's about that's sort of realistic, and it would still represent a career season for him. So there's that. He is part of the recipe, a big part of the recipe. In fact, I would say he's probably, if you're going to prioritize the things that Canucks need to be successful, I think that goaltending is probably one, along with the power play, along with the production of Pettersson and the young guys. But the goaltending is right up at the top.
When you look back through Canucks history, though, you know, maybe the year that they lost in Anaheim to a good Ducks team, and it was Luongo was literally. You know, the Sedins hadn't truly blossomed yet, but you knew it was like Luongo standing on his head every night. This team's supposed to be better than that. This team is supposed to have talent. So, you know, how come they aren't carrying their load more than the goaltender?
They've had trouble defending all year, wouldn't you?
Trouble defending, yeah. And we kind of gloss over the fact that, yeah, they score on the power play, but they don't score at even strength.
Yeah.
You're 20th in the league at even strength scoring. You're not going to make it to the dance. They've got to probably have 23 wins in their remaining games to get to that 94-96 bar to get into the playoffs. It's doable. And like you said, goaltending, you're not going anywhere without goaltending. And there is a back-to-back on this trip. So you can do the Markstrom-Demko thing. But it's more than just Markstrom. It's what's happening in front of him and that's what not happening in front of him. I see him. You talk about 918, 2.69, that area, goals against average. These are career numbers for Markstrom. He's not that guy who couldn't handle the position, who couldn't handle us years ago. And everything he's gone through with the passing of his father. Quite frankly, I thought he was going to have a meltdown. It would have been when he came back to the team in that game in MSG when they were under siege in the third period. They won the game and he let everybody know after what was going on.
So. But if you look at, you know, obviously, as we will talk about the Canucks' 50th anniversary later and how their history is littered with goalies who were always their strongest player. But
Kurt Ridley. For example, and we have a poster of him, so he must have been great.
Ridley got that poster just on the basis of his mask, but no disrespect to Kurt. But, you know, this looking ahead now to the Canucks, you talk about Markstrom career numbers, Ben. He is, I don't want to call him a late bloomer, but he's hitting this elite stage later in his career, contract coming up, wants to be paid. You figure this is his meal ticket, right? This will be his biggest contract. What do the Canucks do? I mean, is Demko happy playing second fiddle longer? Do you have to take into a couple of concussions into effect with Demko? I mean, honestly, how big a question is this for the front office as you head towards whether it's the trade deadline or the offseason, whatever you want
to think
at?
It's a big one because, to be honest, I think they wanted to see with Demko, with Markstrom running with the ball again, what's it going to be like through the first half? What's it going to be like if we get into a stretch drive run here? Night after night, Demko simply hasn't played enough games. You referenced the two concussions, Paul, in 15 months. He just doesn't have the body of work yet. So if you're Jim Benning and you're sitting down with your negotiating team, the one thing Jim said to me a while ago was a little disturbing to me. He said he thought Markstrom could play for another 6 or 7 years. Well, he's turning 30. You mean 6 or 7 years somewhere else? Or I would be comfortable in an extension that's probably not beyond 3 years because of Demko and because of DiPietro. But by the same token, you've got the expansion draft in Seattle, and you've also got a situation where you're going to get into this term versus money. If you can get them on a shorter deal, they're going to push for more. If you go long, you might get them at a bargain price. So I don't, you know, you look at comparables out there. The question is he a $6 million goalie? I think that's what they're wrestling with.
Expansion drafts and goalies. Maybe we should have a John Van Beesbrook poster. Ed, what would you do with the goaltending situation?
I'm fascinated by this.
Because
the economics of the goaltending position is completely different than the other positions on the ice. I from the Canucks' point of view, I'm pretty confident in saying I think they want him in that Freddie Anderson 5.5 range. They think they can get him there, and that'll probably mean a bit of a longer term. And I know Markstrom's camp is going to look, no, he's the number one. The number starts with a 6. He's also a UFA, so you know, does that inflate it a bit? So there's going to be a real kind of push and pull here to try and bring him in. And then the other thing is, you know, while they're doing this, they've got to have their eye on what's coming down the pipe, which is a huge contract for Patterson and probably a pretty big one for Quinn Hughes in 2 years too. And they're tight against the cap right now. So Chris Gear, the new assistant general manager and the new lead, well, he's not the new lead negotiator, but he's out front now. I mean, he's got
legal
his work
stuff.
Cut out for him. Huh?
Legal stuff.
Contract stuff. He's not the capologist, though, as I learned last night. I just thought, you know, I kind of put him in as the new Lawrence Gilman, which made him all those things. But Jonathan Wall's the capologist.
Yeah, Jonathan is responsible for that part. And there's a lot of analytical stuff that goes into the assessment of what you should be paying these guys. And I think that's where there's been some symmetry in terms of, you know, let's have a more direct route when we're talking about contracts, because we talked the other day about the contracts that are up on the roster. There's 19 in the organization that need addressing.
So you talk about an eye on what's going on down the pipe. All that, okay, fine. If they want Markstrom for, you know, he's going to want longer term, he's going to want more money. Now you've got the Demko question on top of, so what happens there? Is this an either or do you think they can keep both?
I think they can if they get Markstrom at the number they want. But, you know, here's the other really interesting part. When you look at the 31 teams, and their goaltending. It basically breaks down into three areas. There's kind of the elite one, which is like Carey Price making $11 million, Bobrovsky making $10 million. He's a little different animal because, you know, he was unrestricted. There's the high level. For the most part, the vast majority, and I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 of the 16 teams, they're paying between $5.5 and $7 million for their goaltending. So that's the number one. That's the backup. So that's kind of the scenario, a little bit of what the Canucks envision, I think, where they sign Markstrom again to that 5.5 and then bring, you know, Demko along. The other one, and this is the interesting part, there's the teams that just cheap out. That are paying virtually nothing for their goalie. And a great example of that is Columbus, who I can't even remember that they've got these two random Europeans they've thrown in, and they've been fine. They've given them an acceptable level of goaltending. So do the Canucks roll the dice and think Thatcher Demko and Mikey DiPietro, or Thatcher Demko and, you know, take your pick of any one of Thomas Greiss, whoever it might be. Can they give them that level of goaltending for, say, $4 million a year?
Well, I think
that's an interesting one, isn't it?
I think the interesting thing from a Canuck perspective, and this could be a really short conversation, if they walk into the room with Markstrom's representatives and say, well, Mikko Koskinen in Edmonton is only making $4.5 million a year and his numbers are comparable to you. That's going to be a very short conversation. And the Braden Holtby at $6 million for a guy who's, you know, has a pedigree, won a cup, but also hasn't been playing that well. So there's that, again, it's that $6 million question. But I think the bigger one is, in the back of my mind, I think the Canucks are thinking, what happens here? What happens if Markstrom gets hurt? I mean, he's been very durable. 60 games apiece the last 2 years. He's very durable. But there's always the what if with the Canucks. Markstrom gets hurt, now it's Demko carrying the mail all the time, all the way in DiPietro. I think when it comes to the Seattle expansion draft, I don't think it's something you go public with. There's got to be a side deal. Listen, don't touch our goalie and we'll do you a favor. Right now, you could argue they got the best goaltending in the division. And this is something every team strives for, a 1A, 1B, well, whatever scenario you want.
To Ed's point, though, this is why I do find this, you know, and I love how the directions you guys have taken this subject, but I find this absolutely fascinating because, again, as we've talked about before, goaltenders have no trade value. And the goaltenders that you talked about there, Ed, Bobrovsky and Price, well, yeah, we're all expecting a Canadiens Panthers Eastern Conference final, aren't we? This idea of overpaying your goaltender, yet if you don't have it, and we've seen that sink Canucks teams of the past. So I just think it's an absolute conundrum in the NHL how you want to take your goaltending. I don't think there is one model that you take it to. You mentioned Braden Holtby. Well, sometimes when someone wins you a cup, you pay them afterwards as the reward, but I don't know. I don't see where it's going here. If you look at the Canucks numbers, and Ben, I know you got a bunch written down there. I mean, they're 14th in goals against, 11th in goals for, 19th in penalty kill, but it's that fourth overall in the NHL in their power play. They've just won, prior to yesterday, they won 7 games in a row. They lose one, and they're technically out of a playoff spot. Now, they have a couple of games in hand on Calgary, are only 1 point ahead, and they're actually even with Winnipeg, who, you know, by virtue of, I think, a coin flip at this point, gets them that last spot, but that margin is razor thin.
Well, you know, and that's why I can't let go of this goaltending thing because goaltending and power play. Fair. And that's the recipe, really. That's it. And, you know, contributions from the Tanner Pearson and Jake Virtanens of the world. But, okay, so, you know, given, and I think we can all agree they've made strides this year, they've made some advancement. Do you roll the dice on that? You have a chance to secure the most important position in the team for a guy that you've spent 5 years trying to develop, who finally seems to have emerged as that guy you've wanted. Do you risk losing that and putting your faith in Thatcher Demko and Mikey DiPietro to save yourself probably in the neighborhood of $5 million for a team that is tight against the cap to begin with? So there's just so many variables in this equation. To me, it's absolutely fascinating.
I just think there's this underlying thing within the Canuck organization about the what if. You know, is Jacob Markstrom a bona fide number one goalie? Some people will say, yeah, he's a good goalie. You won't put him in the conversation of the best goalies in the league. Yep. We talked about injuries and subpar performance. Demko not having the body of work yet, and DiPietro probably another couple of years away. There's always this underlying what if with the goaltending situation. And that's why, like Paul said, this is so fascinating. I don't know where they go contractually. I do believe they're going to say, listen, just, you know, leave our goalies alone. We'll do you a favor in the expansion draft.
I just one other thing, and then we can move on to this. But I was talking to Kevin Woodley, the goalie whisperer, right? And I said, I put, you can't see this. This is good radio. I put my pointed finger up to his skull and says, I'm holding a gun to your head. Who's the best goalie in the NHL right now? And he thinks for a minute and he goes, Robin Lehner or Jordan Bennington. Mm-hmm. Now, you asked that question 2-3 years ago. Jordan Bennington
was that question
in the mind.
A year and a week ago.
Exactly. Goaltending, it's such a funny position. It's so many. You just never know. And yes, there are guys. There's the elite.
Well, there was Patrick Roy and Martin Brodeur, which kind of everyone's
said. Modern equivalent of that is what? Henrik Lundqvist. I think you put Price in there for his body.
Right, no, but I'm just saying is back
so,
then, when you had like Roy and Brodeur almost single-handedly winning cups, I think the people were scrambling. We need a superstar goalie, a guy who will play, you know, 75% of our games and just drag us through the playoffs. And then teams put a lot of money in their goaltender, and they didn't have money for the other players, and it hasn't worked since.
Yeah.
Correct?
No, I think that soon is a lot more than 75%. It was, you know, you're talking about starting goalies in that 65 to 70 game range. Who's Brodeur's backup? Was it Craig Billington? He had one of the great careers.
The Bunny LaRocque of the 90s?
That's exactly who he was. He was playing 10, 15 games a year and getting a check and getting the Stanley Cup money.
Jim Sorge of the NHL.
Yeah, you're right. And I just wonder about the psychology of being Canucks. And I think sometimes they kind of default to the worst case scenario just because it's been enacted so many times. And I think that's one, it's another kind of variable that plays out in this negotiation with Markstrom. Does that give him an edge just because they're so shit scared of what might come if he goes and Demko turns out to be unready for it, and then everything they built up to over the last 4 years goes right down the tubes?
I think history has shown us that they'll probably hitch their horse to Markstrom longer than maybe we can collectively agree they should.
Yeah.
Because of the scared whatever of what could occur should he get hurt or he falls off, and then what?
Yep.
We've got two great guys coming up, but... You know, and this is the funny thing about goaltending today. You know, it's a willingness to grasp things. A lot of guys don't really want to change their style. And Markstrom said he was, you know, kind of resistant to Ian Clark because he plays goalie a certain way. And now it's different stuff, the way you seal up the short side, the way you move post to post, tracking, whatever. The one thing that Markstrom said about Demko, he's ahead of me. He's grasped things a lot quicker than me. He's a better learner than me. He's a better student than me. But to Markstrom's credit, he's grudgingly accepted all this, and you see it in his play. He's, you know, there's not a lot of muffins. There's not that soft first goal. His glove hand's better than it used to be. His tracking's better than it used to be. But having said all that, it doesn't mean anything because, like you said earlier, Ed, there's this underlying thing about goaltending in Vancouver and a team that's trying to get to the dance for the first time in 5 years that needs to get to the dance. This isn't about, you know, it's going to be, it's even if they get eliminated in 5 games, it's about taking that next step as an organization. And I think they're a little scared about that and what happens after.
So let's look at their next 10. Obviously, I'm finishing this road trip, Florida, Buffalo, Minnesota, Winnipeg, then they're home for Arizona and San Jose, or I think they're at San Jose, then the All-Star break. Then the All-Star break, then St. Louis, then at San Jose again, and the Islanders and Carolina, and then they, you know, there's two more games on that, another road trip. So where are they at the end of those 10 days?
So you touched on the one team I'm fascinated with, and that's the Arizona Coyotes. They've got them 4 times. They haven't played them yet this year, which is so weird.
No.
But they've got them 4 times, and to me, that I've always kind of over the last couple of years, I've kind of like compared where the Canucks are to where the Coyotes are, and very similar. You know, they're just tanked horribly for an extended period of time, tried to build through the draft, seemed to have accumulated some really nice pieces. I think Arizona a little more aggressive in the trade market, getting Kessel and then going after Tyler Hall, kind of trumps getting JT Miller, in my opinion. But to me, I don't know if this stands up to scrutiny, but to me, if the Canucks finish ahead of the Arizona Coyotes, they're in the playoffs. I think it comes
fair,
down. To, I think
where
it
we
comes.
Are right now.
Yeah,
you,
I think it comes.
You talked
to
about
that.
Kessel. Yeah. You talked about Hall.
Yeah.
You talked about Clayton Keller, who was there last year. The Canucks did not beat the Coyotes last year. They got 2 points out of the four meetings. So 8-2. There's 6 points. And we know they finished 9 points shy, 10 if you count the tiebreaker. But they couldn't beat them last year, and now it's even a better team.
No, that's right. And I thought they were exposed last year against a really disciplined, physical, well-coached Arizona team. They just kind of ground them down. And they're doing the same thing, only they've got a little more firepower. But that backhand of Arizona, I remember talking to Jacob Chychrun at the Young Stars game when it was in Vancouver. And at that time, he seemed like a lot to be a top five pick. Mm-hmm. And I think he got hurt in his draft year, but he plummets all the way to 16th. I mean, he could emerge. That was also the Ylevi draft. He could emerge as the best defenseman in that draft. I mean, he's a top four guy now, and he's in his third year. Anyways, larger point is that they've got as good a blue line as any team in the West, in my opinion. So, again, this is what's up against the Canucks.
And remember, Brad Richardson, that whiskey drinker, had 5 goals in the series last year.
So. What was the year he was the leading goal scorer with 15?
Yeah,
I think they still finished ahead of the Canucks.
Torts gave him the moniker.
Yeah.
Old school.
Ben, where do you think they are in the next 10 games? Like last night, it's a reckoning. It's against a very good team. Quick turnaround, Eastern time zone, all that stuff. You're looking at the teams that they've got coming up the rest of this trip. Florida, Buffalo, Minnesota, Winnipeg. Not exactly murderer's row, but not a bunch of cupcakes either.
Every time I think I have the team figured out, Paul, they do something. Yeah. I expected them to lose in Tampa. I really did. I think this is coming. This is like a prairie storm. I could see this one coming. They're not winning that game. But they're very likely to rebound and go into Florida and win. But I would say on this trip, the rest of this trip, I say Buffalo's a very difficult game. And do they ever win in Winnipeg, Ed? Is there something
It's the curse of the queen on the old
rink wall staring at them. You're not doing a line change.
The curse of the trough.
It's the forks.
You have to know the Winnipeg Arena to understand that.
I just think the Coliseum
had a trough too, I should say.
I guess what I'm trying to say is it's every time I think they're going to win a game, they lose it, or they find ways to win games I don't think they're going to win. So I think they'll be 500. I think they'll stay in the mix because, like we talked about earlier, when you have the fourth-ranked power play, and if you would move the puck a little bit better on PP1 and not be so predictable and get some movement there and not just collapse on guys who are going to shoot the puck and get some even strength scoring and some secondary scoring, I think they can be a 500 team in that stretch. I think they'll stay in the mix.
At this point of the year, and Ben, I know you just did a big sort of at the halfway mark point on us. Is there anyone who needs to step their game up in the second half specifically?
Well, I think collectively, I think as much as they improve the back end, I think it's a problem. The funny thing about the Canucks, they try to push the pace and that doesn't work for them. So they try to get aggressive with playing a north-south game. And sometimes that involves being aggressive defensively. And Tyler Myers is turning the wrong way at the opposition blue line and you've got a breakaway. I just think their biggest concerns are not moving the puck out because they got the get out of jail free card in Quinn Hughes. But when it comes to their defending, boxing guys out down low, and even the Tampa game, I think just to expose their lack of foot speed on the back end outside of Hughes, it's a concern. And knock on wood, Chris Tanev isn't hurt yet. I thought again, Alex Edler had a horrific game in Tampa, so that concerns me the most. It's their defending, it's their first decisions with the puck. I mean, Edler throws the puck right up the gut against Tampa. Beagle, it's intercepted. Boom, it's in the net. So my biggest concern, aside from even strength scoring, is the way they defend. They're not helping their goaltender.
Ed, anyone for you need to see?
Yeah, for me it's Brock Besser because I still don't know who he is, and I've been watching him for what this is his third year, right?
Well, when he stepped in and ended up being the MVP of the All-Star game,
yes.
And I know that's an exhibition, but. It's like, wow, they've got a superstar here.
No, and that's just it. And he's fine, but they need more from him than to be like a 25-goal, 65-point guy. He's playing on, and I know he's trending for a little more than that, but not a whole lot more. And I just haven't seen him be a difference maker. I've seen him being a nice complimentary piece, a nice piece on the power play, works well with Patterson, has made... developed this playmaking aspect to his game, but he's a goal scorer. I mean, that's what he was advertised at, and that's what he certainly was looking at, and I just haven't seen that dimension that year, and that changes so many things. If he's a 35-goal guy, that changes so many things for the Canucks.
That's a great point, Ed, because I talked to Besser Christmas time in Calgary. Did an all-additions piece on him about – you talk to people around the NHL, the first thing they say about Besser is watch his stride. His first three, he doesn't have any explosiveness in his stride. So that means he can't do things off the rush. He has a hard time keeping up with Patterson and Miller when you see them moving up the ice. In year one, he was a guy who would take the puck, go around the offensive net and look for somebody, look at his options, take it to the net, shoot, score. I don't know how much that back injury comes into play. People have told me the problem with Besser, he doesn't really work on his skating in the summer. He works on all over. So he doesn't have a power skating coach per se. We know what Bo Horvat was like in year one. We know what Bo Horvat's like today. I've had people tell me his biggest problem is he doesn't dedicate himself enough. So I broached that topic with him. He said, well, if you do it enough in practice, if you're not, you know, just go hard on every drill, you should be okay. I think that's missing in his game because he's not getting into the positions. And maybe, you know, people have told me when you've had some sort of a back issue, it never, ever really goes away. So when you're planting your foot and where's that puck going? Are you hesitating? Are you not picking your spots? And the other thing from the Canucks' perspective is that they're so hard on him to be better defensively that he's got to get back, and he's given it, you know, he was really bad at it last year in terms of just not getting marking his man well enough. So he's concentrating a lot on that. And he told me, well, you don't have to skate fast all the time. Well, I didn't quite understand that, but I think what he meant was you got to read the game better from an IQ perspective, have those short bursts. But I still believe that his skating is part of his problem. It's not getting him into the right positions. And maybe when he plants that foot, maybe there's still a little bit of a tug down there for some scar tissue.
Ed, switching gears, you did write about the new Canucks AGM today. This, I don't know if it was nitpicking or people just like to take shots. There was a lot made of the Canucks front office and how they maybe were cutting corners and cheaping out. They look like they're correcting that a little bit with some of their appointments, and I know they're internal. But it looks like they've got a little more structure in place now, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think when you look at it now, you're looking at a team that mirrors the accepted model in the NHL now. And I don't think you can accuse them of, you know, going overboard. And that's fine if you've got good people in place. But, you know, I don't think you can look at the gear appointment in isolation. I think you have to take in Chris Higgins. I think you have to look at the expanded analytic department. You've got like the two senior advisors now. They took Doug Jarvis from behind the bench and made him the kind of this like roving eye for the organization, pro scout emeritus kind of thing. And they've always had a really deep scouting staff. So I just found the timing really interesting of the gear announcement. Like, why now? And they just look at all the contracts they've got coming up. Some of the criticism they took last year for the threadbare operation they were running. And I think it was for gear, but I think there was also a message they were trying to send to the fan base.
I like the fact that they didn't go outside the organization and say, you know, we need a president of hockey ops or whatever you want to call it. The strength of any organization is to play to your strengths. I mean, a lot of talk about Judd Brackett. Well, maybe Judd Brackett should be the assistant general manager. He's done such a great job with the amateur scouting side. No, he's playing to his strength. We know what Jim Benning's all about. He's drafting. That's how he cut his way. Pretty good at player evaluation. John Weisbrod spends up to 200 days a year on the road scouting. So you've got guys playing to their strengths. I like what they've – I think they have some really good symmetry now and pretty decent communication. And everybody kind of, quite frankly, stay in your lane and do your job. We don't need to parachute somebody in. I think this was a great move.
Patrick Johnson was so on me all the time about them not having the award winners up to date painted on the wall. I was ready to go down there with a paintbrush myself and get it done. But his point was attention to detail and are people in pro sports today, you just can't sleep on anything. You need to be ahead of the curve all over the place. Now, brings us to our final topic here. I was lucky enough to go with some friends who'd won a charity auction to the Pittsburgh game and be hosted in the Canuck alumni suite and hosted by Darcy Roeder, who was absolutely magnificent. Got to tip my hat to Darcy, and he told some great stories. Also in the suite were like Doug Hallward, Harold Snaps, Kirk McLean, Gary Volk, a bunch of the old trainers.
Was there any beer drunk at that time?
Well, if you consider Budweiser a Bud Light beer, which was the funny thing, I think this is the way they've got going. Like the alumni suite's at the very top in the end. But And it's like they don't have the GM place selection. You get the media meal and they have their own boxes of Bud behind the counter. So I'm not sure what's going on there. However, yes, there was lots of beer drunk. I have to tip my hat to the organization in that they have embraced their past. They are bringing other people back into the fold. There's more pride in the organization top to bottom. While we were planning our part in this series and the promotions that we've done, I had a chance to meet with a lot of the Canucks sort of marketing and social media team. They got some fantastic talent there. Like this organization seems to have caught up in many ways. I know there were criticisms around the draft and how they ran things. But overall, I look at what they've done, embracing their alumni, and there's a lot more to come now. And I know you guys have had some fun writing these stories and revisiting some of these old characters. It was long overdue, was it?
Oh, yeah. No, and they've kind of like dipped their toe in that water a little before, but I don't know if it's the 50th anniversary that's brought everything to a head. It just seems to me they've embraced it a lot more enthusiastically than they have in years past. And I know just from like our point of view, it can sometimes be a little difficult trying to get a hold of people, but no, they've stepped right up. Put a phone call in for just tell Arthur Griffiths I want to get in touch with him. And about 2 hours later, he gave me a call. So I think they see the value in the stories we're trying to tell here. And we certainly do. And Ben and I are both kind of the same era when it was accessibility was a little different with these players, where you actually got to know these players on a little more human level, where the exchange was a lot different than it was now. And to me, this is going back to the glory days of my youth, not that like 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's been really rewarding. And as a writer, that's what you want. You want that access. You want the ability to mine these stories and really extract some stuff out of it. And that's what this opportunity is given
me. I would say as a former chapter chair of the Writers Association, I would say the PR department is trending in the right direction. It's an ongoing process, whether it's the elevator or Wi-Fi or accessibility of players in today's mass media. It's different. But what Paul touched on about the alumni, I think they make great strides there. You know, it's interesting doing this 50th anniversary feature. And when you talk to players like Kirk McLean or Cliff Ronning about putting that jersey back on and being out there for the celebration nights and the anthem, they're quite emotional about it. And I think that says a lot because they gave a lot. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. You know, you give up a lot to be a pro athlete and to have the organization kind of, I'm not going to say come full circle, but get these guys back out maybe on the front burner in terms of a relationship-wise, sure. Not just having alumni games, but having them more visible and more accessible. And quite frankly for us, I mean, I've had a ball doing this series. I mean, to this day, I'm still talking about tracking down Ron Settlebauer in Burlington, Ontario. And that's when he fantastic. Finally opened up, he was unbelievable. Yep. So good on the Canucks and, quite frankly, good on us for doing this.
But what's fascinating is, I'll immediately key our poster series where we've already had Bure, we had Courtnell today, and we've got Dave Babich tomorrow.
How did the Kurt Ridley poster sell by that? I'm sorry.
Very well.
I'm sorry for keep coming back to this.
Very well.
You just love it.
And I will point out, you can go to the Canucks store and you can get
Kay Whitmore,
these nice...
Is there a Kay Whitmore poster coming up next?
There might be. I'm not sure. No, there might be.
It would not surprise me.
You can get these high-gloss version of the posters if you're not collecting them from the actual province paper. And they are having autograph signings at Rogers Arena, so you can get them through the Canucks store. You can search it out at the Canucks website as well. But what does fascinate me is we're doing the stories to coincide with how they are celebrating the decades. And of course, this is the 90s. And while we had the excitement of the team joining the NHL in the 70s, and then just the absolute dearth of success that was so funny in the 70s, led to this false dawn, but these great characters around the 82 run, and then the team plummeting. When I look at what you guys have coming up, and I know you're doing one on Pat Quinn, Ed, and Ben, you've got this great piece on Pavel Bure and his explosion into this team. I look at the 90s now. When I look at you, you had, you know, Quinn, Bure, Linden, the 94 run, you know, bringing in Mogilny, but then you had the crash at the end with Messier and Keenan, and maybe the worst era of Canucks hockey we've ever seen. Like, when I'm looking at these decades now, the 90s was fascinating.
No, I and you're right, because I'm sorry, when I think of the 90s of the Canucks, I think of the Pat Quinn teams. It, which really only goes to what, 94, 95? When does the fun start? It's 96, 97 is when it kind of all starts to go haywire. Right,
because they changed.
Because that's the first Messier year.
Well, funny thing is, they changed the uniforms, they moved into their own building.
Yeah.
And Quinn famously told a story. They went out and got McGillney and thought the NHL was trending that way, and that's where to revisit Brodeur and the Devils.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the league had the rug pulled out from them, but that team was terrible late 90s. But you're right. When you think of 90s, you think of the skate. You don't think of the whale.
Yeah, no, that's right. And it is. And again, I'm just starting the Pat Quinn, so that's kind of, you know, the area of my focus. But, you know, as Ben and I were saying, it's not only the accessibility, it's the willingness of these people to tell their stories, which is just so great and so refreshing. And I'll just reference I had a conversation with Arthur Griffiths for about 15 minutes about the circumstances around Pat's hiring. And he tells this, he told a couple of great stories, but he tells this great story about meeting him, and he's coaching the LA Kings at the time. So there's some subterfuge going on. So they arranged to meet in San Diego. And if people haven't been to San Diego, the Del Coronado Hotel is this amazing landmark on the water. It's this big, huge dome from the turn of the 20th century. And he meets there, and he describes the scene, you know, with Pat smoking a cigar the size of a canoe and going back and forth. And then Pat finally stopped. Frank Griffiths is there, the owner of the team at the time. Pat stops and says, well, what do you want out of this? And Frank Griffiths says, I just want you to bring us back towards respectability. And when you think of where the Canucks had been for the previous really since the 82 run, which is such a one-off anyways, but, you know, they'd just been dreadful really throughout most of their existence. And Pat gave them that credibility that they'd been searching for. Yeah, just a really kind of neat moment in the franchise's history.
Yeah, we're transferring into that interesting late 90s time where I think when I was just doing some part-time stuff on the beat during Mike Keenan's reign of whatever, I thought I was better served just to go to YVR and look for somebody carrying a hockey bag, because I think there were 19 transactions that 1 month, and anybody who had the secret decoder message ring from Mike was coming to play for the Canucks. So what a transition.
No, well, yeah. So I remember the All-Star game was in Vancouver, and yeah, I came in as an out-of-towner that year to kind of assess the damage. I was actually doing a lot of freelance work. So it was the New York Times. I'm not name dropping. I did, really was. And they sent me here to really do it because Messier was in Vancouver and what had gone wrong. So I did that. And then lo and behold, I got the job here some months later. So I was in year two of the Keenan reign, but Brian Burke's first year, and Mardi Gras broke out. Anyways, the trades had all happened by then. So all like the craziest stuff, I think on par, it happened. Most of it had happened the year before, but there was still a lot left in the bag that year. Not the least of which was, of course, Brian telling everybody that the clock doesn't start ticking on Mike Keenan until we trade Pavel Bure, and trading him two games after that deal is made. So it was, fun for all.
Just as we finish up, I don't want to do the get off my lawn segment, but, you know, as we are revisiting history, and I remember you telling me several times you'd be on the road and you're walking back into the hotel maybe after dinner, and there's Burke sitting at the hotel bar and say, come over here. Does that kind of stuff ever happen today?
Well, Ben's on the road a lot more.
I think it's harder to get him out of the bar than have my favorite. This is great. One of the greatest stops in the league, and people don't understand this, is Minnesota, St. Paul, the turn of the century hotel, Grill, the rink's a block away. 1 year I'm flying from Washington, before our latest travel agency was somebody before who booked me on an airline that didn't exist. So I eventually got to the St. Paul Hotel late afternoon, couldn't wait to have a shower, go down, have a decent meal. The phone rings, not the cell phone, the phone rings, okay? It's Tony Gallagher, our ex-colleague, going, Trevor effing Linden? So I knew at that minute, no shower, down to the lobby, players are going, coming from dinner, they didn't even know about it. Write that version, go back down, find more guys. I got to get Crow. Crow's in the bar. He's reluctant to come out. He eventually comes out. Wrote version number two. That's it. That's a great night. I'm going to go have a meal. Who walks in the front door of the hotel? Trevor Linden. Story number three. So Yeah, it was great. I just think from that perspective, I occasionally see people in an establishment, and if I do, I leave it because yeah. I think you want to keep a professional distance with players and even management.
Well, especially in this yeah. day and age, there yeah. was a time when I'd be very comfortable having yeah. a drink in the hotel bar, but it's not anymore. We covered the 2007, it was the year Anaheim won the Stanley Cup, but there was a bunch of out-of-towners because they were playing Calgary in the first round, and we're in the and actually, it was a nightly occurrence. We'd sit around with Berkey and Chuck Fletcher, who was his assistant general manager, whoever else. Bob Murray was there a couple of nights too. And there was me and Terry Jones and Cam Cole, like guys who'd been around a little bit. And then we would sit there for 3-4 hours. Just he'd tell stories, he'd hold court, you know, people would tell their own stories. And I remember turning to Brian and said, you know, there's not a lot of people in this day and age you could do this with, and that was like 12 years ago. So try and imagine it now. But I want to get Ben to tell, it's my favorite Mark Crawford story, the story of Mark Crawford in Atlanta, the Summer Crow story where he's holding court in the bar.
This is crazy. I mean, it's Atlanta, and it was back in the day when the team used to book a lot of our hotels. And the next thing you know, we're staying at the Ritz-Carlton. And I'm like, are you kidding me? So I come out and I'm trying to figure out where to go for dinner. And Elliot Papp, a former colleague at the Vancouver Sun, came up behind me and he's kind of like sheepishly wondering what we should do. Mark Crawford comes up behind and says, let's go. And I'm going, okay. We go back into the hotel, the long lobby bar. They're going back into where the good wine is, decanted. So suddenly I've got this glass of wine I could never afford. The next thing you know, Crow wants the guy to get the Cubans out, even though they weren't supposed to serve Cubans. I'm sitting at the bar sipping this ridiculously velvety red wine with a Cuban cigar, and Elliot Papp is beside me, and he's like, can't even believe what's going on. And we talked a lot that night, a lot about hockey, a lot about life in general. I thought, man, whoa, this is great. I mean, what a great way to get to know the coach. The next night, they lost to the Thrashers, and the infamous Dean Sylvester scored 3 effing goal. So needless to say, that night with Crow, that night never happened again. And nothing even close to that, because our relationship with Crow was really tenuous at best. Yeah. There was a lot of colorful language. But yeah, that was a rare occurrence to actually – it was like I was in a twilight zone sitting in that bar with Mark Crawford that night.
Well, like, expensive cigars and wine. It's a long way from my stories where Joe Pow with the BC Lions knew the team had gone into receivership. So he said, we can spend what we want on the credit card. Who wants to come to the keg? A little bit different. We'll leave that there. Everyone, thanks for listening. Again, you can watch our Whitetail videos at theprovince.com and vancouversun.com. Read Ed and Ben's insight every day at our websites, or pick up the printed product, continue with our poster series. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you guys next week.